Hello, this is Chris Wilhelm, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, September 26th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Today's headline, Grand Jury Indicts Longtime Trump Target, Former FBI Director James Comey. The move came after the president intensified his pressure campaign on the Justice Department in recent days, publicly demanding that top officials prosecute Mr. Comey. By Devin Barrett, Glenn Thrush, and Alan Foyer. A federal grand jury on Thursday indicted James B. Comey, the former FBI director, a culmination of President Trump's relentless demand for retribution after the Bureau investigated his 2016 presidential campaign over possible ties to Russia. Mr. Comey was indicted on one count of making a false statement and one count of obstruction of a congressional proceeding in connection with his testimony before a Senate committee in September 2020. The indictment, filed in Alexandria, Virginia, came over the objection of career prosecutors in the Eastern District of Virginia, who found insufficient evidence to support charges, but were overruled by Lindsey Halligan, a Trump loyalist handpicked by the president to run the office a few days ago. It represents the most significant legal step yet by the Trump administration to harry, punish, and humiliate a former official the president identified as an enemy at the expense of procedural safeguards intended to shield the Justice Department from political interference and personal vendettas. The bare-bones two-page indictment was signed only by Ms. Halligan, a former defense lawyer for Mr. Trump, who personally presented the case to the jury, despite her lack of any previous prosecutorial experience. Typically, such filings are also endorsed by career prosecutors who have gathered the evidence in the case. Court records indicate that Ms. Halligan also tried to get the grand jury to indict Mr. Comey on a second false statement charge, and that it was rejected. In a video statement, Mr. Comey declared his innocence and welcomed an opportunity to vindicate himself in a trial. "We will not live on our knees, and you shouldn't either." Referring to his daughter Maureen, who was dismissed this summer from her own post at the Justice Department, he added, "Somebody that I love dearly recently said that fear is the tool of a tyrant, and she's right. But I'm not afraid, and I hope you're not either." Mr. Trump praised the move, posting on Truth Social shortly after the indictment was announced, "Justice in America," he wrote. For a charging document as consequential as an indictment of a former FBI director, the filing was not particularly revealing. It asserts that Mr. Comey falsely claimed during the hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee that he had not authorized someone else at the FBI to be an anonymous source in news reports regarding an investigation into Person 1, which appears to be a reference to Hillary Clinton. That statement was false, the indictment charges, because Mr. Comey had, in fact, authorized Person 3 to serve as an anonymous source in news reports regarding an FBI investigation concerning Person 1. The document does not identify either Person 1 or Person 3, but at the hearing, Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, pressed Mr. Comey on whether he had ever authorized his former deputy, Andrew McCabe, to discuss an investigation with a reporter. Mr. Comey stood by his answers at past hearings and denied doing so. Career prosecutors who looked at the evidence against Mr. Comey thought the case was far too weak to justify an indictment, according to people familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity. For one thing, the key exchange was brief. For another, it referred to testimony from 3 years earlier, and Mr. Comey said he stood by those answers without elaborating. The vague description of authorizing someone at the FBI to share information with a journalist could also apply to a different episode from that period. Republicans have criticized Mr. Comey over designating a college professor he trusted, Daniel Richman, as a special government employee who then spoke to a reporter for the New York Times. The wording of the indictment leaves unclear which of those two situations is at issue, though in recent days, investigators had re-interviewed Mr. Richman, according to people familiar with the matter. Mr. Comey faces up to 5 years in prison if convicted, although many current and former prosecutors believe the case will be difficult to prove. Shortly after the indictment was made public, Troy A. Edwards Jr., Mr. Comey's son-in-law, resigned his post as a prosecutor in the office that brought the charges against the former FBI director. Mr. Edwards, who helped prosecute January 6th rioters, including members of the far-right Oath Keepers, said in an email to his supervisor that he left to uphold his duty to the Constitution and country. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, in a statement, warned that the indictment underscored how the president intended to deploy the justice system. This kind of interference is a dangerous abuse of power, he said. Our system depends on prosecutors making decisions based on evidence and the law, not on the personal grudges of a politician determined to settle scores. Mr. Trump, who claims his actions are motivated by the weaponization of government against him, has intensified his public pressure campaign on the Justice Department in recent days. He has publicly called upon Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, to use her power to go after adversaries he has described as scum, including Mr. Comey and Letitia James, the New York Attorney General who sued Mr. Trump for inflating the value of his assets. Ms. Bondi and her top deputy have quietly raised concerns that the case against Mr. Comey was too weak to result in convictions, according to current and former officials. But she appeared to embrace the move in a social media post, without mentioning Mr. Comey by name, writing, "No one is above the law." The FBI director, Kash Patel, suggested on social media that the indictment would not be the administration's last against what he referred to as previous corrupt leadership and their enablers. He added, "Everyone, especially those in positions of power, will be held to account, no matter their perch." Many current and former Justice Department officials said they viewed the filing of criminal charges against Mr. Comey as deeply troubling. The consequences could be far-reaching, they argued, including the resignations of more prosecutors over how the Trump administration has sought to use the agency and the erosion of public trust in U.S. attorneys. Last week, Mr. Trump, impatient with the lack of charges against two of his most frequent targets, forced out the U.S. attorney overseeing those investigations, Eric S. Siebert, in the Eastern District of Virginia. In his place, the president installed Ms. Halligan, his White House aide and one of his former defense lawyers. The investigation into Mr. Comey has focused in part on whether he misled lawmakers during testimony in September 2020 about the Russia investigation. The statute of limitations on that testimony expires on Tuesday, meaning the clock was ticking on any related charges. The justification for directing prosecutors in Virginia to investigate Mr. Comey's congressional testimony was that he appeared remotely during the pandemic from his Virginia home. Mr. Trump has long sought to turn the criminal justice system against those who have investigated him. Unlike in his first term, Mr. Trump has stocked the uppermost positions of the Justice Department with fierce loyalists, and they have pursued a criminal investigation into Mr. Comey, the former director of the CIA, John O. Brennan, and others who, in Mr. Trump's telling, have plotted against him. After securing an indictment at the federal courthouse in Alexandria on Thursday evening, Ms. Halligan entered a courtroom to notify a magistrate judge of the outcome, accompanied by a group of nearly a dozen prosecutors, including Maggie Cleary, Ms. Halligan's top subordinate. The judge, Lindsay R. Valla, noted that the grand jury did not indict Mr. Comey on one of the counts, but voted to charge him on two others. "I'm a little confused," she said. "This has never happened before." Judge Valla, who recognized the unusual hour given the prosecutors reached their chambers well past the typical hour that grand juries are dismissed, "I don't think we've ever met this late," Judge Valla told a juror. Mr. Comey is not the first former head of the FBI to face criminal charges. In 1978, a former acting head of the Bureau during Watergate, L. Patrick Gray, was indicted on charges of conspiring to violate the constitutional rights of Americans. Prosecutors said he authorized agents to break into homes without warrants in a hunt for fugitive members of Weather Underground, the far-left militant group. The charges against Mr. Gray were dropped 2 years later. Mr. Comey, who was confirmed as the seventh director of the FBI in 2013, was abruptly fired by Mr. Trump 4 years later as his bureau investigated whether members of Mr. Trump's campaign had conspired with Russian intelligence operatives seeking to interfere in the 2016 election. Mr. Comey's firing eventually led to the appointment of a special counsel, Robert S. Mueller III, to oversee the Russia investigation, a fraught 2 years from which Mr. Trump emerged with his presidency more or less intact. Mr. Trump's enmity only intensified over the years as he railed against what he called a witch hunt. Mr. Comey, in turn, became one of the most high-profile critics of the president, comparing him to a mafia boss. As Mr. Trump campaigned for a second term and faced multiple criminal indictments, Mr. Comey warned that a second Trump presidency posed a danger to all Americans. By then, there was little doubt that Mr. Trump's return to the White House posed a particular danger to Mr. Comey. The case in the Eastern District of Virginia is one of three that the Trump administration has opened related to Mr. Comey, according to people familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity. In the Western District of Virginia, federal prosecutors and agents have in recent weeks interviewed a number of former FBI officials about how certain classified documents related to the Russian inquiry came to be found in certain parts of FBI headquarters in 2025. That investigation, according to those familiar with the effort, is premised on an unsubstantiated theory pushed by Trump supporters that senior intelligence officials at the FBI and elsewhere tried to hide or destroy secret documents that might cast doubt on the investigation, also known as Crossfire Hurricane. The inquiry has bewildered many current and former law enforcement officials, since the printed copies of classified documents have for decades been backed up on computers. Internally, Justice Department officials have justified placing much of that investigation in Western Virginia because the FBI operates a document storage facility in Winchester, west of the Northern Virginia suburbs, according to people familiar with the matter. Some Trump administration officials have been reluctant to impanel grand juries in Washington in politically sensitive cases because of concerns that jurors and grand jurors in the largely Democratic city will be resistant to cases against Mr. Trump's perceived foes. Todd Gilbert, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Virginia, abruptly resigned over the summer, only a month after being appointed to the job. The office has declined to give a reason for Mr. Gilbert's sudden departure. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Amazon to pay $2.5 billion to settle claims it tricked Prime customers. The settlement is one of the largest in the history of the Federal Trade Commission, which sued Amazon 2 years ago, by Karen Wiese and Cecilia Kang. Amazon agreed to pay up to $2.5 billion to settle claims that it tricked tens of millions of people into signing up for its Prime membership program, and then made it hard for customers to cancel when they wanted out. The settlement announced on Thursday came days into a jury trial that began in Seattle this week over the issue, which stemmed from a lawsuit filed by the Federal Trade Commission in 2023. The lawsuit cut to the heart of how Amazon defines itself as a champion for the hundreds of millions of customers who regularly use its online shopping service. Though less sweeping than an antitrust case that the FTC has filed against Amazon, the suit targeted the company for the way it runs a popular subscription program central to its business and ubiquitous in the lives of many of its customers. An estimated 200 million people in the United States use Prime to shop on Amazon. Subscriptions, primarily Prime, brought in more than $44 billion last year. But Prime's value to Amazon goes far beyond the monthly fees. Prime members are the company's best customers. They buy more things and buy more frequently than people who are not signed up for the service. And the settlement will not fundamentally change how Amazon interacts with those customers. Nobody likes a trial, said Josh Lowitz, a partner at Consumer Intelligence Research Partners, a research firm that has surveyed Prime customers for more than a decade. He said Prime was wildly popular, but Amazon clearly decided that $2.5 billion and ending the story before the Christmas season was probably a good plan. The settlement shows a continued push by the Republican-led FTC against the biggest tech companies, despite their executives' many attempts to court President Trump. This year, Mr. Trump fired the two Democratic commissioners, leaving three Republican members leading the agency. In 2023, Lina Khan, the FTC's Democratic chair, filed a suit against Amazon, accusing it of squeezing third-party sellers on its marketplace and favoring its own services in a way that raised costs for customers. The case is active, and Amazon denies the claims. In the Prime case, Amazon agreed to pay $1 billion in penalties and between $1 billion and $1.5 billion in payouts to customers, who could get $51 each if they qualify. The agency said it was one of the largest settlements in its history. Amazon did not admit or deny wrongdoing in agreeing to settle. Amazon and our executives have always followed the law, and this settlement allows us to move forward and focus on innovating for customers, Mark Blafkin, a company spokesman, said in a statement. He added that Amazon worked hard to make it clear and simple for customers to sign up or cancel their Prime membership, and we look forward to what we'll deliver for Prime members in the coming years. FTC Chairman Andrew Ferguson has been a vocal critic of the biggest tech companies, which he has accused of stifling speech and using their power to crush competition. He's continued to pursue antitrust lawsuits against Amazon and Meta that began with his Republican and Democratic predecessors, and has started investigations into artificial intelligence companies over concerns about children using chatbots, as well as tech giants' investments in AI startups. Bill Kovacic, former chair of the agency, said Mr. Ferguson was particularly motivated by the power of Amazon, Meta, Google, and other tech platforms had over speech. He's using his levers to enforce consumer protection and antitrust laws to rein in the power of the platforms, Mr. Kovacic said. The agency, he expected, will continue its charge against the technology giants. We get more than we even originally told the judge we needed, $1.5 billion going back to consumers, and $1 billion in civil penalties to make sure that Amazon knows you can't get away with this kind of conduct again, Mr. Ferguson said in an interview on Fox Business Network. The FTC case centers on the idea of dark patterns, whether a website's design knowingly steers customers into subscriptions they don't really want or makes it too complicated for them to cancel. For example, it documented that when someone wanted to buy an item, Amazon showed a page with an orange button that blared "Get free same-day delivery" that would enroll the customer in Prime. If someone didn't want to enroll in Prime, the only way to proceed with a purchase was to click a small text link that read, "No thanks, I do not want free delivery." Amazon had argued that its practices were standard for the industry. Under the terms of the settlement, that kind of language would be explicitly prohibited, though Amazon said it would be able to maintain the sign-up and cancellation process that had been in place for several years. The company and the FTC had been discussing a settlement for a while, and they continued the conversation even as the trial's first witness, a former Amazon employee, took the stand on Tuesday and testified that the company was aware some people unwittingly enrolled in Prime, according to two people familiar with the talks who were not authorized to speak publicly. The settlement with the company expires after 10 years. Two executives who have overseen Prime, Neil Lindsay and Jamil Ghani, agreed to personally abide by the commitments for 3 years. Under the agreement, Amazon will, within 90 days, give $51 to customers who went through the sign-up process that the FTC had questioned. To qualify, customers must fit certain criteria, such as signing up between June 23, 2019 and June 23, 2025, and barely using Prime benefits like video streaming after they enrolled. Amazon will also notify other customers that they can submit a claim if they believe that they unintentionally enrolled in the program or wanted to cancel but were induced not to by offers during the cancellation process. The company will pay between $1 billion and $1.5 billion to customers depending on how many make claims. Some tech policy experts say the action isn't strong enough to deter similar behavior. Ordinary people would go to jail for this kind of fraud, but Amazon and its corporate executives can write a meager check to skip their day in court while keeping their jobs and reputations intact, said Nidhi Hegde, executive director of the American Economic Liberties Project, a left-leaning organization. After the settlement was filed with the court, Judge John H. Chun excused the 9 jurors and concluded the trial. White House threat of federal layoffs only deepens shutdown impasse. Democratic leaders said the administration's plan to fire government workers in the event of a shutdown would not prompt them to drop their demands in their spending standoff with the GOP. By Tony Rahm and Katie Edmondson. With only 5 days remaining to fund the government, the White House's threat to conduct mass federal firings was a bid to maximize the pain of a possible shutdown and pressure Democrats into caving and accepting a short-term deal. But beyond the political gamesmanship, it was also the latest step by the Trump administration to pursue deep cuts to federal programs and personnel, which conservative Republicans have long targeted out of a belief that government is too large and does too much. The move underscored the intransigence gripping the two parties as they barrel with no negotiations underway toward a highly disruptive shutdown on October 1st, driven by opposing political incentives and policy motivations. Democrats on Thursday condemned the threat by Mr. Trump and his top aides to fire droves of federal employees during a federal closure, and said they would not be cowed into dropping their demands for health care spending concessions because of it. "We will not be intimidated by your threat to engage in mass firings," said Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York, the Democratic leader. Hours later, Mr. Trump, who has declined to negotiate with Democrats he has accused of being not realistic in their demands, said a lapse in funding would be their fault. "This is all caused by the Democrats," he told reporters in the Oval Office. The White House began its campaign of fiscal brinksmanship earlier in the week after Mr. Trump set, then abruptly canceled, a meeting with Democratic leaders to discuss the terms of a spending deal. The president instead attacked Democrats for blocking a Republican-written plan to fund the government into November, which they rejected because it failed to meet the demand for rollbacks of looming health care cuts. By late Wednesday, the White House sought to ratchet up the stakes, issuing a memo to federal agencies that instructed them to prepare for mass firings in the event that the government runs out of funding on September 30th, the close of the fiscal year. The president's aides also suggested that they could restrict agencies from moving around funds to preserve some of their operations during a shutdown. The ultimatum raised the odds that the government could grind to a screeching halt next Wednesday, leaving millions of federal workers out of work or reporting for duty without pay. In a shutdown, the consequences can be wide-ranging: closing parks and museums, snarling air travel, halting food safety inspections, and preventing businesses from obtaining permits and loans. The disruptions can harm the economy as well as families and businesses, which is why presidents often seek to ease some of the pain from funding lapses. Even Mr. Trump has previously sought to cushion the blow, allowing agencies to move around funds during a 5-week shutdown, the longest ever, that occurred in his first term. But Mr. Trump has approached the latest fiscal showdown as a potential political advantage, an opening that might allow Republicans to further whittle down the size and reach of government. In his second term, the president has spared no effort to slash spending, even sometimes without the express approval of Congress, and fire thousands of federal employees. By Thursday, it was not yet clear whether the White House would make good on its threat to begin another round of mass layoffs. In the memo, the Budget Office only instructed agencies to prepare reduction in force notices, the official federal process for firings, if Congress cannot reach a spending deal by the end of September 30th. The directive appeared to leave unresolved whether the Trump administration could proceed with some staffing cuts later in the year, even once funding resumes. The memo drew pushback from one Republican on Capitol Hill, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, the chairwoman of the Appropriations Committee. "We must pass a clean, short-term continuing resolution to prevent a harmful government shutdown and allow Congress time to complete the annual funding bills," Ms. Collins said in a statement. Federal employees dedicate themselves to serving the public, and they should not be treated as pawns amid a needlessly partisan impasse. The White House did not respond to a request for comment. Many agencies have been trying to hire back employees who were previously laid off or fired under Mr. Trump, or who resigned under pressure from the Department of Government Efficiency. In other cases, fired workers have challenged the legality of their dismissals. Union officials sharply attacked the Trump administration on Thursday for even considering such firings near the eve of a shutdown. Federal employees are not bargaining chips, Everett Kelly, the president of the American Federation of Government Employees, said in a statement. They are veterans, caregivers, law enforcement officers, and neighbors who serve their country and fellow Americans every day. They deserve stability and respect, not pink slips in political games. But if the White House memo was aimed at wearing down the resolve of Democrats, there was little sign that it had changed their calculus. President Trump will try to abuse a shutdown, just like he's trampled our laws for months. But that doesn't mean he gets whatever he wants as a result, Senator Patty Murray of Washington, the top Democrat on the Appropriations Committee, said. This is nothing new. Donald Trump has spent the better part of a year chaotically and indiscriminately firing and then rehiring essential government workers. Democrats have said they would not allow any stopgap spending legislation to move forward unless it also included more than $1 trillion to continue Obamacare subsidies that are set to expire in December and reverses cuts to Medicaid and other health programs that Republicans made over the summer. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the Democratic minority leader, called the White House memo an attempt at intimidation. Donald Trump has been firing federal workers since day one, not to govern, but to scare, Mr. Schumer said in a statement. This is nothing new and has nothing to do with funding the government. These unnecessary firings will either be overturned in court or the administration will end up hiring the workers back, just as they did as recently as today. In March, Mr. Schumer and a group of Senate Democrats voted to allow Republicans temporary funding legislation to advance, in part because they argued that a shutdown would give Russell T. Vogt, the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, even more power to decide what money to spend and which parts of the federal bureaucracy to starve. Mr. Vogt has long sought to shrink the federal government and has led the Trump administration's efforts to usurp Congress's power of the purse. Democrats have made an entirely different calculation in the current funding dispute. They have noted that Mr. Trump continued his assault on the federal bureaucracy even after they agreed to fund the government in the spring. And they have argued that with unpopular Medicaid cuts in place and the Obamacare subsidies slated to expire, they have a mandate to demand concessions from the GOP, which they believe will pay a political price for refusing to agree to them. If the subsidies expire on December 31st, as scheduled under current law, around 4 million people are projected to lose coverage starting next year, and premiums would increase for around 20 million more. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that 10 million more Americans would become uninsured over the next decade as a result of the Medicaid and other health cuts included in Mr. Trump's tax cut law. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. What declines in reading and math mean for the U.S. workforce? U.S. employers and colleges are contending with more young people who are behind academically. Some are trying to make up where schools have failed. By Sarah Mervosh. The U.S. military is seeing lower scores on its Armed Forces Qualification Test. At Texas State Technical College, a two-year college based in Waco, students increasingly have to take a basic math class alongside their college-level courses to get ready for careers in welding, heating, and air conditioning, and manufacturing. And at selective four-year colleges, professors complain that students have lost their reading and writing stamina. New national test results for 12th graders released this month showed significant declines in students' math and reading abilities since 2019, results that are now being felt in college and the labor market. My students now, they leave high school and don't have the capacity to read a lengthy 25-page article. They don't know what to do with it, said Deepak Sarma, a humanities professor at Case Western Reserve University, where the average reported SAT score is between 1440 and 1520. Mr. Dharma recently counseled a student daunted by a dense academic article, suggesting basic tactics like printing it out in order to highlight and underline key passages. On the national test, students' reading scores were the worst in 3 decades, and math scores were the lowest since 2005. The scores are at least partially explained by the pandemic and school closures, but they also reflect broader societal changes, including an increase in time spent in front of screens for both young people and adults. The decline was primarily driven by lower-scoring students, who have been losing ground for a decade. The results have vast consequences for a generation of students, the U.S. economy, and the country, which already ranks 28th in the world for math, behind Japan, Canada, the United Kingdom, Germany, and nearly every major industrialized democracy. The U.S. is an example of frogs in the boiling water when it comes to talent, said Jamie Marisotis, chief executive of the Lumina Foundation, which is focused on higher education and workforce credentials. Because the United States has a large and diverse economy, he said, it's harder to see when the rest of the world is catching up. The world's highest performing countries not only produce students who outscore the brightest American students at the top, they also manage to lift far more students up to a base level of skill, something some experts believe is only going to become more important in a world of artificial intelligence. AI can do the first draft of the memo or solve the math equation, Mr. Marisotis said. It is the worker who needs to understand what they are reading, be able to ensure it is accurate, and decide what to do next. Fundamental reading and math skills are needed for a wide range of jobs, employers and industry leaders said, from healthcare workers calculating medication dosage and documenting patient care to truck drivers navigating the nation's highways. There is a lot of math that you don't necessarily think about, said Lindsay Trent, president of the Next Generation in Trucking Association, a trade group, who said that even entry-level drivers must be able to calculate weight distributions on their trucks and estimate mileage without exceeding federal limits for hours on the road. Randall Stevenson, who was the chief executive of AT&T from 2007 until 2020, said that during his tenure, the company screened candidates for math and other basic skills, which often required going through a large pool of candidates to make a single hire. Anybody who's going to be doing basic customer interactions, working on billing issues and rates, what is the right rate plan for a customer? Simple basic math is absolutely required, Mr. Stevenson said. He has now turned his attention to education. He and his wife funded an intensive math tutoring program for high school students in the Oklahoma City area who are at the bottom 25th percent of their class. Even as scores have fallen, there are few indications that dramatically more students are dropping out. Nationally, 87% of students graduate high school on time. Only about 5% of young adults don't have a degree or a high school equivalency diploma. Instead, students are graduating with fewer skills, leaving them less prepared for college and beyond. At Texas State Technical College, students who arrive needing help are placed into a fundamentals class to be taken alongside their college credit courses. The school tries to emphasize why academics are necessary for each line of work, said Clidia Hernandez, a vice chancellor. Fractions, for example, are essential for pipe fitting, where a job may come down to 1/16th of an inch of pipe. Nationally, there has been little political will from either party to meaningfully lift student outcomes. While Republicans focus on giving parents more education choices, including helping families pay for private school and homeschooling, Democrats have spent political capital on what they see as root causes for challenges at school, like poverty and mental health. One of the largest ever federal investments in education, $122 billion for pandemic recovery during the Biden administration, did little to raise scores across the board, in part because it required districts to use just 20% of their money on academic recovery. About 62% of high school graduates immediately enroll in college. The rest make their way into the workforce, hoping to make a living without taking on debt. They can make about $23 an hour working at an Amazon warehouse or work to build up their skills and experience in the construction industry, where a crane operator might bring anywhere from $45,000 to $80,000 a year. I'll be really honest, this industry is less concerned with test scores than any other industry, said Jackie Roscos, director of the Specialized Carriers and Rigging Foundation, which works with crane and rigging companies focused on specialized transportation projects, such as replacing parts of a bridge. She said companies care far more about building on-the-job skills and safety experience than any test score. It's so highly skilled, and they need so much experience, she said. It's not because they can't read and do math. Still, experts said, many workers become limited when they try to climb the ladder and move into higher-paying roles. Yes, you can probably get an entry-level warehouse job with very limited math and reading skills, but then what? And whose responsibility is it to help that individual? Said Jeff Bulanda, vice president of the ASA Center for Career Navigation at Jobs for the Future, a nonprofit that works to bridge education and the workforce. Employers need to now step in, he said, because our educational system failed. Guild, a talent development company, works with companies like Target, Chipotle, and Tyson Foods to help their employees get a high school equivalency diploma and master basic math and English skills. In the last 2 years, the company has gotten more requests for foundational learning, which includes math and helping non-English speakers become more comfortable with the language, Guild's chief executive, Bijal Shah, said. It goes back to things like customer service, she said. The U.S. military, the nation's largest employer, is also taking on training of its own. The Army and the Navy offer academic prep courses aimed at helping recruits with lower test scores become eligible for a wider range of jobs across the military, a Pentagon official said. At least part of the solution may lie in helping students get ready to work before they even leave high school. WellStar Health System, which operates 11 hospitals in Georgia, partners with several high schools to produce a pipeline of new talent. Students can work part-time at WellStar while still in high school, earn a healthcare certificate, and graduate with a job offer. The company sees it as a win-win, helping students establish stable careers while also addressing a workforce shortage. Yes, the learning gaps are real, said Laura Daniels, WellStar's chief talent officer, but rather than seeing that as a barrier, we see it as a call to action. Trump says he won't allow Israel to annex the West Bank. After more countries recognized a Palestinian state this week, President Trump said on Thursday that he would not permit Israel to take over the territory. By Adam Rasgen and Maggie Haberman. President Trump said on Thursday that he would not allow Israel to annex the Israeli-occupied West Bank after assuring leaders of Arab and Muslim-majority nations of his stance on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly. I will not allow Israel to annex the West Bank, he said in the Oval Office. He added, there's been enough. It's time to stop now. Mr. Trump's remarks came on the eve of a speech by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the General Assembly, where several countries declared their recognition of a Palestinian state this week. Israeli officials have recently suggested that their government could annex at least part of the West Bank in retaliation for decisions by nations like Canada, Britain, and France recognizing Palestinian statehood. Mr. Netanyahu has faced growing calls from right-wing allies to extend sovereignty over the West Bank. On Sunday, Itamar Ben-Gvir, a far-right minister, called for the government to adopt the measure immediately. Mr. Trump offered assurances on annexation during a meeting with the Arab and Muslim-majority nations in New York on Tuesday, according to three people familiar with the matter, including an Arab official. They spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive details. The meeting included the President of Turkey, the Emir of Qatar, the King of Jordan, the Foreign Minister of the United Arab Emirates, the Prime Minister of Egypt, and other regional and Muslim leaders. President Emmanuel Macron of France told France 24 and Radio France Internationale on Wednesday that Mr. Trump agreed with him that Israel expanding settlements in the West Bank was counterproductive and had nothing to do with Hamas. Mr. Macron and Mr. Trump met on the sidelines of the General Assembly. The possibility of annexation has prompted rebuke in the Arab world. Palestinian leaders in the West Bank, and much of the world, have long envisioned that the territory would form part of a future independent Palestine. About 3 million Palestinians live in the West Bank, which Israel has controlled since the Arab-Israeli War of 1967. Around 500,000 Israelis also live in the West Bank, in settlements scattered across the territory that the Palestinians and much of the world consider to be illegal. If Israel unilaterally annexes part or all of the West Bank, it would underscore how distant the prospect of a Palestinian state has become. Many Palestinians, however, say that Israel's policies toward the West Bank, including stringent restrictions on Palestinian movement and construction in the territory, already amount to a de facto annexation. Palestinian officials have said that while recognition carries great symbolic value, it does not change the harsh reality experienced by Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. On Sunday, Mr. Netanyahu reaffirmed his opposition to Palestinian statehood. "There will be no Palestinian state west of the Jordan River," he said. "For years, I have prevented the establishment of this terrorist state facing tremendous pressures at home and abroad." During the meeting, Steve Witkoff, the U.S. Envoy for Peace Missions, summarized the details of an American plan to end the war in Gaza, according to a White House official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss the conversation. "The plan calls for the release of all hostages held in the territory and a cessation of hostilities," the official said. During the Hamas-led October 7, 2023 attack on southern Israel, about 1,200 people were killed and 250 abducted. Many of the hostages have since been returned to Israel, but the authorities believe that 20 of those still held in Gaza are alive. Hamas has said it would release all remaining hostages in exchange for a permanent end to the war, the withdrawal of Israeli forces, and the release of Palestinian prisoners. Mr. Netanyahu has refused to end the war unless Hamas effectively surrenders by disarming and exiling its senior leaders, conditions that the group has publicly rejected. On Wednesday, Mr. Macron also said he had asked Mr. Trump to pressure Israel to end the war. "You have a prominent role to play," he recalled telling Mr. Trump in the interview with the French broadcasters. "You who supports peace and wants to make peace in the world." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Sarkozy sentenced to 5 years in Libyan campaign funding case. Nicolas Sarkozy, former president of France, was found guilty of plotting to finance his 2007 election bid with help from the government of Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi. By Aurelien Breeden. A court in Paris on Thursday found Nicolas Sarkozy, former president of France, guilty of criminal conspiracy to seek funding for his 2007 campaign from the government of the one-time Libyan strongman, Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi. The court sentenced Mr. Sarkozy, a conservative politician who led France from 2007 to 2012, to 5 years in prison and ruled that the incarceration would be enforced in the coming weeks regardless of an appeal, a harsh sentence that is unprecedented in modern French history for a former president. "If they absolutely want me to sleep in prison, I will sleep in prison, but with my head high," Mr. Sarkozy, looking grim and flanked by his lawyers and his wife, told reporters at the courthouse. Mr. Sarkozy, who repeatedly denied any wrongdoing during the three-month trial this year, called the ruling a scandal and said that he would challenge it. "Those who hate me so much think that they are humiliating me," he said, but he added, "Those they have humiliated are France and its image." The ruling, which elicited gasps from some in the courtroom, was perhaps the most severe and most damaging blow to Mr. Sarkozy's legacy. It was not his first conviction, nor even his first prison sentence. Since leaving office, he has already been found guilty of corruption, influence peddling, and campaign spending violations in separate cases. He has also been stripped of France's highest distinction, the Legion of Honor. Until now, though, through appeals and other means, he had remained free, and while he no longer holds any public office, he is a well-regarded figure on the right who retains some political influence. But on Thursday, for the first time, it suddenly became likely that Mr. Sarkozy, now 70, would spend some time in prison, if not the full 5 years, a humiliating outcome for a man who rose to power in part on the image of a tough-talking, crime-battling politician. Since 1945, only one other French head of state had been found guilty by a court of law. Jacques Chirac, who was convicted in 2011 of misusing public funds when he was mayor of Paris. But no former president has ever spent time behind bars. Prosecutors had accused Mr. Sarkozy of being a central figure in a Faustian corruption pact with Libyan officials to funnel money to his 2007 campaign through bank and cash transfers, offshore accounts, and sham transactions. In return, prosecutors said, Libya wanted economic deals, diplomatic recognition, and possibly assistance from France in rescinding an arrest warrant against Abdullah Sanusi, Colonel al-Qaddafi's brother-in-law, who was wanted for the bombing of a French airliner in 1989 that killed 171 people. Seven other defendants were found guilty, former top aides to Mr. Sarkozy when he was interior minister from 2005 to 2007, and who met with Mr. Sanusi in Libya. At that time, the court noted, the Gaddafi government was trying to shed its pariah status, and Mr. Sarkozy was mounting a presidential bid but did not yet have the assurances that he would have his party's financial backing. The court said that Mr. Sarkozy and his aides had conspired to solicit funds, which is enough under French law to secure a conspiracy conviction, but said that it had found insufficient evidence that such funds had actually landed in the campaign's coffers. Nathalie Gavarino, the presiding judge, said as she read out the court's 400-page ruling that Mr. Sarkozy had allowed top aides who worked under his authority and acted in his name to obtain or try to obtain funding from Libya. Ms. Gavarino said that there was evidence that Libyan funds had transited to France in 2006, but that the path they took was opaque, and that the court had seen no firm proof they had been used in Mr. Sarkozy's campaign. The court also said that there was no evidence of deals having been struck between Mr. Sarkozy and Colonel al-Qaddafi, who was killed during an uprising in 2011. To that end, Mr. Sarkozy was cleared on charges of illegal campaign financing, concealing the misappropriation of public funds, and passive corruption, which refers to receiving money or favors. But Ms. Gavarino said that there was nevertheless enough evidence that Mr. Sarkozy and several of his aides had conspired to engage in corruption at the highest possible level, an extremely serious act that she said was likely to undermine citizens' confidence in those who represent them. These facts make it necessary to impose a prison sentence, she said, though the court imposed slightly less than 7 years the prosecutors had sought. The verdict capped a sprawling case that stretched over a decade with twists and turns. Mr. Sarkozy had strenuously denied any corruption pact, arguing that the accusations were driven mostly by allies of Colonel al-Qaddafi seeking revenge. Under Mr. Sarkozy's leadership, France played a prominent role in the NATO-led campaign of airstrikes that ultimately led to the toppling of Colonel Qaddafi and his death at the hands of Libyan rebels. Mr. Sarkozy's legal team also noted that the investigation, which started in 2013, had found no conclusive evidence that Libya had sent millions, as some former Libyan officials had claimed. In 2021, Mr. Sarkozy was found guilty of trying to obtain information from a judge about a court case against him, a ruling that was upheld on appeal. He was sentenced to 1 year under a form of house arrest with an electronic bracelet, which he wore for several months but was able to remove this year after he turned 70. At that age, France allows convicts to request conditional parole. He was also convicted in 2021 on charges of illegally financing his unsuccessful 2012 re-election campaign, which wildly exceeded France's spending limits. That case is still going through the appeals process. Sandra Cozart, the head of Sherpa, an advocacy group that combats corruption and that was one of the plaintiffs in the case, hailed the verdict on Thursday as severe but fair. She noted that France had historically been lenient toward white-collar crime. "It's a historic decision," Ms. Cozart said. "I hope it marks the end of a certain way of doing politics." China bought $12.6 billion in soybeans last year. Now, it's $0. China stopped buying soybeans from America in May, placing a retaliatory tariff on the bumper crop after President Trump increased levies on goods from China. By Kevin Draper. Each week, the Agriculture Department publishes a summary of the latest exports of American crops. Lately, they have all been missing the same thing, the sale of soybeans to China. Soybeans are the single largest American export to China in terms of value, $12.6 billion worth last year. But as the fall harvest gets underway across the country, 9% of planted beans had been harvested as of last week. The country that bought 52% of all American soybean exports last year is completely absent. September 1st was the beginning of the new marketing year for soybeans, the starting point for big sales. Instead, China hasn't bought any American soybeans since May. The cause is retaliatory tariffs China has placed on the United States, making the price of American soybeans unattractive for buyers there. Throughout the summer, farmers hoped the Trump administration and China would reach a trade agreement that would drop the tariff on their crop. But so far, no relief was forthcoming. Through July, China bought 51% fewer American soybeans than during the same period last year, according to the Agriculture Department. Other countries like Egypt, Taiwan, and Bangladesh are buying soybeans from the United States, yet total soybean exports are down 23% this year. Already, the consequences are stacking up for American farmers. On Monday, the Trump administration pledged to support Argentina as it faces economic turmoil. The same day, Argentina suspended its tax on exports of a number of key crops, including soybeans. Shortly thereafter, Chinese companies bought more than 1 million tons of Argentine soybeans, according to Reuters, increasing the nation's ability to hold out from buying the crop from America. The real worry, though, is what is to come. Soybean prices have been subdued, trading at around $10 a bushel for much of the past year, down from around $13 at the start of 2024. The sale of soybeans in the spring and summer is always slow, as China and other countries turn to Brazil, which harvests in February and March. Typically, more than half of American soybean exports are sold between October and December. If Chinese buyers continue to stay away, American soybean farmers will be in a rough place. Continued slow sales of soybeans and an expected bumper corn crop in a number of states are raising worries that there will not be enough storage space for grains this fall. There are fears that grain elevators, which buy and store large quantities of crops before selling them, will simply stop accepting soybeans, as they lack confidence they'll be able to export them. Politicians from big farming states, like Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, an influential member of the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry, have highlighted the harm to farmers from the trade dispute with China and called for negotiators to reach a deal. The Trump administration has noticed. "We care very much about the fact that China has stopped buying our agricultural products," Kevin Hassett, the director of the White House National Economic Council, said on Fox Business Network on Thursday. Also on Thursday, President Trump said he would like some of the money raised from tariffs to go to farmers. Brooke Rollins, the agriculture secretary, said at a separate conference on Thursday that the government wasn't ready to announce a relief plan for crop farmers. Ms. Rollins also said that the United States would develop more international markets for its crops through trade deals. "Farmers need to stop relying on a country that isn't aligned with our values as a major agriculture purchaser," she said, referring to China. But she admitted that for farmers, Mr. Trump's trade negotiations were bumpy and uncertain and unconventional in American history. An Italian city is considering a dog tax for tourists and locals. If you want to bring your dog to Bolzano in northern Italy, it may cost you $1.75 per day. For locals, it's 100 euros a year. By Victor Mather. Drivers in London, New York, and other major cities are used to being charged for bringing cars into the city. Now, one municipality may demand payment to bring dogs into town. A bill in Bolzano, Italy, would mean that dogs bringing their owners to the Tyrolean Alps for some scenery and mountain air would face a new charge of roughly 1.5 euros, $1.75 a day, the Italian news media reported. Local dogs won't escape under the bill, which would come into force in 2026 if it is approved by the Provisional Council. Residents would be charged an estimated 100 euros per dog per year, bringing back a dog tax that was abolished in 2008. These taxes would replace a policy in Bolzano that requires DNA testing for all dogs. The testing requirement, used to identify dogs that left waste behind, as well as those that were struck by cars or that attacked people or other dogs, had been in effect for 2 years. It had proved difficult to implement, with only about 12,000 of 30,000 dog owners complying, in part because of the $50 plus cost of the DNA test. Naples started a similar program in the 2010s. The cumbersome DNA requirements are unlikely to be mourned. I'm pleased that the provisional government has finally chosen the path of common sense and decided to end the DNA registry, one counselor, Thomas Widman, told the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera. Those who did get DNA tests for their dogs would be exempt from the new tax for 2 years. Dog waste on the streets of Bolzano, which is in the province of South Tyrol and near the Austrian border, is a serious problem, Luis Walcher, a counselor who introduced the measure, told the Italian news agency ANSA. Dog owners are required to pick up waste or face fines of 200 to 600 euros, $235 to $704, and those fines may increase as part of the new plan. Officials say that the money raised from the dog taxes will go to street cleaning and building dog parks, which the city is mostly lacking. Not everyone is happy about the plan, and that includes the mayor. Perhaps bidding for the doggy vote, Mayor Claudio Cororati, speaking on RTL Radio, "We would be dogs to impose a tax on dogs." Asked if such a tax were likely to go into effect, he said, "In Bolzano, not, for sure. Come to Bolzano with your animals." To solve the dirty sidewalk problem, he suggested using neighborhood watches to thoroughly report those who disrespect their neighborhood, and told the news site Salto that the city should provide more dog waste bags. Carlo Rocci, president of the Italian animal rights group ENPA, said, "This measure not only penalizes families and tourists who choose to travel with their dogs, but also sends a profoundly flawed message, turning animals into a fiscal ATM." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Friday, September 26th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chris Wilhelm. Thank you for listening.